Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and today I'll be discussing strategy. The essence of strategy is straightforward. It's the craft of summoning and using power to achieve particular aims amid the chaos of global affairs and the resistance of rivals and enemies. It is the indispensable art of getting what you want with what you have in a world that often seems set on denying your aims. Hard power and serious history is now back in style. In the wake of the war in Ukraine, amid much else, we can no longer believe, as was argued a generation ago, that war and perhaps strategy itself have become passé in an era of post-Cold War peace and the supposed end of history. Fierce competition, punctuated by the threat of catastrophic conflict, is the grim reality of our time, from which we cannot turn aside. The democratic world faces sharp challenges to its geopolitical supremacy and security, more than at any point in decades. Of course, strategy is most valuable when the stakes are high and the consequences of failure are severe. And that's the position in which the West finds itself. This means that the premium on good strategy and on the deep understanding of the history that informs it is becoming ever more important indeed. Our guest today is Sir Hugh Strawn, Wardlaw Professor of International Relations at the University of St Andrews, an Emeritus Fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, where he was Titularly Professor of the History of War. His books, all of them major works, include The First World War, The Direction of War, and Klaus Fitz's On War. And Hugh is one of the contributors to the new third edition of The Makers of Modern Strategy, published by Princeton University Press. And it is to Karl von Clausewitz and his seminal, hugely influential classic On War to which we now turn. So, Hugh, Clausewitz's Vom Kriege is published posthumously in three volumes, I think, in the early 1830s, though it wasn't actually translated into English until the 1870s, I think. I wonder if you could characterise the work. What is so important about it? I mean, everyone knows the one principle that war is the continuation of policy by other means. But there is, of course, so much more to this work that remains seminal. I wonder if you could characterise it in some way, look at a little bit of its origins and tell us about that.
I think the most important thing to understand about von Kriege, and we better call it On War, I suppose, if we're speaking English, is, first of all, it does what it says on the tin, and people sometimes forget that. It is about war. It's not primarily about the relationship between war and policy, although obviously that's a very important set of questions. It is about war, and that's where he began in terms of what he wanted to do. At the end of the Napoleonic Wars, he writes to Neisenau, who'd been one of his memoirs, Prussian general, and says, I'm going to write a book about war, about the theory of war. And what it is, I think, above all, an inquiry. There's a very good distinction, I think, made in French by, on the one hand, Raymond Aron, who wrote a book called Penser la guerre in 1976, in other words, How to Think About War, mm-hmm. And Jean-Jacques Langendorf, who wrote much more recently a book on Jomini, Clausewitz's great contemporary and in many ways much more influential figure, at least in terms of the 19th century, who wrote a book about Jomini just at the turn of the millennium called Faire la guerre, in other words, how to make war. And that is, I think, the big point, that Jomini is providing a how-to-do guide. He needs maps to explain what he's talking about. He's trying to explain that if you're Napoleon, this is how you conduct a campaign in a way that results in a battlefield success. That's not Clausewitz's intent. It may have been his intent originally. I occasionally think about this because he does talk about principles and general ideas in ways that are meant to be instructive. But Clausewitz's principal intent is to understand the phenomenon of war. So it's as much about questions as it is about answers. It's as much about setting up problems and difficulties as it is about producing solutions. And that's precisely why it's had longevity. Because if it had come to a set of snap solutions, as Jomini did, about how to conduct Napoleonic warfare, which is what he, Clausewitz, had experienced, just like Jomini had experienced, it would have dated. And it hasn't. And it's extraordinary. I think everybody who reads Clausewitz, particularly his fans, but obviously not his critics, but everybody who reads Clausewitz, comes back and finds something fresh each time. I've read it off and on for nearly 50 years now, and I still think, golly, when I dip in and find something I hadn't really reflected on before, a fresh insight, or I read something where somebody else has quoted him, and I think, did he really say this? And I go back and check the reference, and he did. And it has an extraordinary range. People say, make great play of the issue that this book is not finished, that it's published posthumously, as you said, and that therefore he never saw this into print. And we have this note, the date of which is disputed, and that's an important point, which says that he regards it as unfinished. My own sort of somewhat cynical view, or flippant view, that some might feel, is that it never would have been finished, because he would always be responding to new evidence, new lines of inquiry, new difficulties. I mean, he sets up lots of general propositions, of which the continuation of war is the continuation of policy by the means is one, but then says, but it's not always true. There are exceptions. There are difficulties. And we can't just dismiss those, because we can't understand war as a phenomenon unless we include the difficulties as well as the general truths.
So that invites, from what you're saying, an engagement with the reader in a way, that unfinished quality.
Absolutely. You bring to it, in some ways, of course, your own preconceptions, and that's part of the problem in how it's read. But you also have to bring to it what Clausewitz's expectations are. And I think the crucial thing here is it has enduring validity, although it is based on a volume of military history which is now over 200 years old. And it is largely based on military history. That's his key core discipline. Yeah. I mean, there are other disciplines that matter in the writing of this book, but history is the bedrock from which he gets many of his ideas, as well, of course, as his own personal experience. But it lasts because it's not technologically determined. There's not been the level of industrialization that Europe will experience very shortly after his death. So he doesn't factor in what technology does. What he factors in to the change within war is political and social change. Yeah. And that has a sort of enduring quality. It's a different form of political and social change in the era of the French Revolution, a fundamental social and political change. But it's not something that doesn't strike a chord with us. Mm. And it, no, do go on.
And just before we get into that changing nature, what you might call the historiography of On War, his wife plays a crucial role in the publication of this work, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. Marie von Bruhl was far better connected than Clausewitz. It's important to remember socially how undistinguished the Clausewitzes were. He becomes a von Clausewitz in the 1820s, but he was born just simple Clausewitz. His father had been an officer in the Prussian army in the Seven Years' War. He was born in Magdeburg in 1780. And I think it's often said that as a small boy, he heard his father and his contemporaries talking war stories, and this had an influence on him. His brother also became an officer. So there is an element of not being quite there and needing to be on the make. I mean, I think, you know, he's an ambitious chap, Clausewitz, but not socially as polished as his wife was. And what's also very important about Mary von Bruhl, quite apart from, you know, their obvious deep devotion to each other, it is a wonderful love story. And indeed, people have written about it as a wonderful love story. And we have their correspondence, because for 10 years, effectively, they were separated, not quite 10 years, but there was a long courtship. And of course, he was away on campaign some of that time, or a prisoner of war of the French. So we know what he's thinking and feeling from that relationship. And she has not only the social connections, but she also is clearly politically very aware. They are living, after all, in a time of political ferment, a time of reform, a time when the fundamentals of the Prussian state are being called into question. And they're all at the heart of that debate. And she gives to him, I think, a great deal in terms of a wider dimension, a wider understanding.
Mm. Now, it remains a preeminent work in this field, strategy, we might say, on war. And yet how it is read, how it's interpreted, has changed enormously over time. I mean, this is this timeless quality that we have about it, rather like the nature of conflict itself. This is the one thing I really want to explore here, is the way in which it has changed. I mean, I wonder if you could track us through what we might call that historiography of On War.
It's a long story. And it's a long story principally because Clausewitz is so rich. So if you arrive with a set of preconceptions and you want confirmation of your preconceptions, you'll probably find them.
Yep.
If you equally want to challenge Clausewitz because he doesn't say what you think he should say in the light of recent experience, then you'll probably find evidence for that too. That is one of the sources of its richness. I think I'm a historian by training, and my inclination is to say, well, you have to begin with Clausewitz's own life, his own experience, because that is where the ideas are formed, even if they become much broader and more diverse than that experience shapes. I mean, it suggests it would be. Later commentators have very largely written it from the perspective of their own times. I mean, each of us, when we read a work of history, sees different things according to our own time in the story of the past. And that is roughly what's happened to Clausewitz. There's a point, a very brief moment in On War, where he says, we can't tell what the future will be. Here we've had the experience of the Napoleonic Wars, a war more extreme, more whole, as he would put it, more entire. Absolute war, he said, is something we might think is theoretical if we had not experienced it in our own times. And then he asked the question, is that what the future is going to be like? Is it always going to be fought at this sort of scale? His postulation is it probably will be, because now we've learnt how to do it, it'll be hard to turn the clock back. But he recognises it's not necessarily going to be the case. Now, if you read that just after the book first came out, you might have said, well, actually, Clausewitz is wrong, because war seemed to have been contained. There wasn't a major European war when people thought there might be in 1830, which was the last time Clausewitz was mobilised. There wasn't a major European war in 1848, a second bout of revolutions in Europe. We described the Crimean War as a limited war. It's not till 1914 that you would look back on Clausewitz and say, bingo, he was right. So where you are, or when you are, depends probably how you'll read this. Mm. And that creates a great deal of difficulty, because each generation of strategic thinkers has judged it reasonably enough. I mean, there's no harm in doing this in terms of his or her own time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that strategic thinker has judged it from Clausewitz's own perspective. So, you know, the question is, do you treat Clausewitz as a historical figure who's a product of the era of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars and the crisis that confronts the Prussian state in that period. And I think you do have to, because you need to understand some of the things he's saying about war in that context. Mm-hmm. Or do you judge it from the perspective, as Michael Howard and Peter Perret, the principal recent translators of Clausewitz, of On War into English in 1976, from the perspective of the Cold War? They wanted to make the book relevant to the late 20th century, and they succeeded massively in doing so, particularly in the English-speaking world. I mean, Clausewitz was not read much in either of its two previous translations. You referred to the one of the 1870s by Graham. That doesn't really have an impact until it has a new edition in 1908. It's the same translation, but in the run-up to the First World War, of course, that this idea of major war and how it should be understood captures people's imaginations, and Clausewitz is then read in Britain, not so much in the US, which is still under the influence of Chomini very largely. And then during the Second World War, a second translation, which is in many ways much the most accurate in relation to the German, comes out in 1943 by a man called Jolies. But it is hard to go to sleep reading that book. It is tough work. But if you're struggling with the German, it's a very helpful tool. There are moments when Clausewitz writes with incredible graphic expression, particularly when he's talking about battle, combat. And there are other moments when there is a classic Teutonic sentence where you're looking for the verb and you can't find the subject and there are endless subordinate clauses. So Howard and Perret in 1976 tried to simplify all that, but at a cost. They also, both of them had served in the Second World War, but Michael Howard especially, both Michael Howard and Peter Perret, but Michael Howard especially wanted to make it relevant to the soldiers of the post-Vietnam Cold War generation. And his translation, or their translation, has dated in consequence, because whereas Clausewitz was trying to write a book for all times, and that shows the scale of his ambition, and in some ways you might say the confidence of the man that he should be ready to try what seems a spectacularly difficult task. And what Michael Howard and Peter Perret were doing, which anchored it very much in its own, in the era of the translation.
And before this, when we're talking about this appropriation of Clausewitz preceding the Second World War, we see it appropriated by Hitler, no less, in 1924, or at least Clausewitz anyway, is invoked by Hitler there. And in fact, the defence of Berlin in 1945 was called Operation Clausewitz.
This relationship between the Nazis and Hitler confirmed what for many before 1939 thought was the problem. I mean, that Clausewitz was a Prussian. Clausewitz stood for war in an unbridled form, and there's plenty in the book that is on that. This was not compatible with the liberal tradition of war, particularly it was not compatible with the thinking of either Britain or the United States, both of which, of course, relied as much on maritime power than on land power. There's nothing on sea power on war. It was what Howard and Perret in the 1970s wanted to put behind them. They wanted a Clausewitz for liberal democracies. And the trouble with that is you write out what appealed to the Nazis. It's an open question whether Hitler ever read On War. He was given a copy when he was in Landsberg prison. But what did appeal to Hitler, and what he ended up referring to repeatedly, including towards the end of the Second World War, Operation Clausewitz in 1945 and so on, was what Clausewitz had written in 1812. And that memorandum, which fortunately for Clausewitz was never published in his own lifetime, or he would never have had a future career in the Prussian army, that memorandum was written in fury and at length by Clausewitz when Prussia was asked, or Prussia, the demand was made of Prussia by Napoleon, that it provided a contingent of troops for his France's invasion of Russia, and for Clausewitz, viscerally anti-French, determined to support the cause ultimately of German nationalism. The memorandum is addressed to the German people. It's not addressed to the King of Prussia. Clausewitz saw this as an existential moment, and he says it's more important, effectively, to fight and die than not to fight at all. And that simply didn't figure in the way in which Clausewitz was looked at from the 1970s, really, until now. I mean, because this is a form of war that some would say does not have political utility. If the state is destroyed in the process of fighting, if the nation is destroyed in the process of fighting, what does remain? But of course, as the Nazis faced defeat, that is exactly what Hitler is asking the German people to do, to express their readiness to be sacrificed in the hope that phoenix-like they'll reemerge from the ashes.
And it's really quite striking, the language of that. If you'll bear with me, I'll just read out a passage, because I think you really get a flavour of perhaps not what we're expecting, but you can see why this appealed to a certain mentality. This is to quote Clausewitz: "I believe and confess that a people can value nothing more highly than the dignity and liberty of its existence, that it must defend these to the last drop of its blood, that there is no higher duty to fulfil, no higher law to obey, that the shameful blot of cowardly submission can never be erased, that this drop of poison in the blood of the nation is passed on to posterity, crippling and eroding the strength of future generations." Now, when I read that, I was reminded a little bit of the final scene of Wagner's Meistersinger. It's quite an invocation.
It is. Good question whether Wagner ever wrote Clausewitz. I'd love to make that connection, being a Wagnerite. I think that what is also striking about that is, think about how it begins. "I believe and confess." I mean, this is the creed. Some of Clausewitz's relatives were pastors. He uses... I think it's unclear what his own faith was, but he certainly invokes religious vocabulary at crucial points. I mean, on War, the famous passage of the Trinity, and that's the phrase that he uses, this notion of three elements within War, clearly evokes the Christian idea of the Trinity and Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, although he's not actually. It's just the way he expresses it. It's obviously what he's been brought up with in terms of language. But that is part of the reason that it resonates in a Christian tradition, because it goes to the fundamentals of what Christians are asked to believe. And to that extent, it's almost blasphemous, I mean, in the way in which it expresses itself. So it is powerful stuff. And I think we have to get to that, because for Clausewitz, this is a war of national survival. He is prepared, after all. I mean, this notion that war is the continuation of policy by other means leads the American theorists of civil military relations to say Clausewitz is the first one to produce a theory of, you know, the subordination of the military to the civil authority. Well, the one thing that Clausewitz does not do is show obedience to the legitimate authority in Prussia, because he resigns his commission in 1812, rather than serve in the Prussian army and invade Russia, and joins the enemy. He becomes an officer in the Russian army, not a very happy experience, because he couldn't speak Russian and he had piles and he was on horseback the whole time, so it must have been a very uncomfortable campaign for him. But of course, there comes this great moment, which he describes in almost ecstatic terms, which is when the Prussians realise at the end of the 1812 campaign that they must change sides and that they must join Russia and its allies in confronting France. And Clausewitz is present when that happens at the convention at Tarog, as the army retreats. And he says, "I heard German being spoken for the first time for, you know, months, and this sense of excitement." And of course, met brother officers from whom he had alienated himself by deciding to making the decision that he had made. So this is a man, and this comes back to the point about the relationship between war and policy. who does not see the relationship between war and policy necessarily in linear terms. The notion that war is the continuation of policy by other means is, if you like, his ideal formulation that is an endeavour to give unity to the whole of on war. But most of the book, of course, is describing not a unity, but a variety. And particularly in Book 8, the last book of on war, he is very clear that actually the relationship between war and policy is much more volatile and fragmented. And there may be a moment when policy is asking for war something it cannot deliver, that it cannot be the continuation of policy by other means. And in that case, he says the policy has to change. You have to be realistic about what the resources are and what war can actually achieve. The challenge here, and this is also very important in how we read the Howard and Perret translation, is how important is that last book of on war, Book 8? And I think it's crucially important. Peter Perret, when he wrote his biography of Clausewitz in 1976, which significantly he called Clausewitz and the State, reproduced Book 1, Chapter 1, as the summary of on war, which is wonderful news for all students, because what it suggests is you don't have to read what was originally published in three volumes. Fortunately, Howard and Perret published in one volume, but it's a big book. You just read Book 1, Chapter 1, and you're done. You know, that's it. Great. And that couldn't be more wrong, in my view, because the justification for regarding Book 1, Chapter 1 as finished is an undated note, which Marie von Bruhl published in her foreword to On War, which says Book 1, Chapter 1, I regard as finished, and which Howard and Perret concluded was written in 1830, which was when Clausewitz was remobilized because of the fear of revolution in Poland, and was packed up his papers and went off to war and never returned to the writing of On War. But most Clausewitz scholars reckon that was written in 1827. There was certainly a crisis in Clausewitz's life. He writes some very depressed notes to Marie von Bruhl at that time, saying, thank goodness we haven't got children, bring them into this terrible world we live in, real midlife crisis stuff. And I suspect that's when he wrote that note, because Book 8 is a pretty sophisticated discussion of how you act. It's called War Plans, after all, about how you do some of this. It's the late 1820s he's been asked to think about war plans. The Prussian General Staff have engaged him on this issue in December 1827. So I would, you know, always say to my students, there are two books of on war you absolutely have to read. Book 1 for sure, and I don't dissent from that, from the importance of that book, but Book 8 as well. Because if you don't do that, you simply won't get an insight into the variety of the ways in which he's tackling what are essentially related problems, but problems to which he finds very different solutions.
Now, that's the work you're talking of 200 years ago, the original one, almost 200 years ago. We've seen a shift from perhaps the 1980s, of which the Howard and Perret edition was the prime motivator, the prime agent, in the way in which On War, or at least their version of On War, has been taken up in the Anglophone world. And what characterises that? What has happened there? Why has it suddenly got this new lease of life?
Well, the short answer is the end of the Cold War. Howard and Perret were writing their translation, published in 1976, the threat of an all-out nuclear exchange was real enough. The problem they confronted was, here's a book about fighting war, essentially, and what you're having to think about is how do you avoid war? It's significant that, you know, the guide to reading on war that comes at the back of that edition was prepared by Bernard Brodie, who was one of the first people to say we have to regard the dropping of the atom bombs as a moment when the object of strategy is to deter war, not to fight war. That is not Clausewitz's understanding of strategy at all. So what Howard and Perret did was highlight particularly this idea of absolute war, which Clausewitz says in Book 1, Chapter 1, but not in Book 8, where he revises that this view, where Clausewitz says absolute war is a perfection which we will never experience. It's an ideal. It's a sort of Kantian notion. And they took that as his final word, which meant that it was an abstract concept to be tested against reality. That, I think, gets Clausewitz completely wrong, because when Clausewitz has a theory that doesn't work in reality, then he goes back and worries at it, saying the theory obviously doesn't stand up. The theory is only useful if it is of practical application. And so if I've thought about a concept which is too pure to exist in this world, effectively, then it is a pretty useless theory. Because, and this is a core dilemma of strategic studies, that actually strategy is in the real world. It's not a theoretical construct. It's about the use of force in by states or organized political groups or whatever else, and it's about war. And so it's got to be applied, and it's got to be thought in terms which have direct application. So after the end of the Cold War, that's what happens. I mean, there is more war around, and particularly, of course, after 9/11. Mm. So what happens is people go back to Clausewitz, not as a sort of way of thinking about the causes of war, which Clausewitz says almost nothing about, but which is what preoccupied people during the Cold War. You know, the whole point about this notion that war is the continuation of policy by other means is it's read by so many international relations scholars as a statement about why war breaks out. Clausewitz was concerned about the impact of policy and probably even of politics, but of course there's an ambiguity about that because of the German word being the same, Politik. Clausewitz was concerned about the impact of policy or politics on war itself, how you fought it. It's the conduct of war he's concerned about, not the causes of war. And so once you're back into the business of fighting war, then you read this text in a different way. And you get much closer to what is concerning Clausewitz at the time of his writing it. And I think it's also reinforced for another reason, which is, you know, if you think of the 1990s and the expectation of the revolution in military affairs, or think even of the current context of the war in Ukraine and the focus on drones and AI and the impact of new technologies, then you will tend to understand war in terms of those technologies. And indeed, in the 1990s, people said, well, Clausewitz is no longer relevant because the whole idea that war is unpredictable, non-linear, goes in confusing directions, is subject to friction and chance, all the things that are central to what Clausewitz is saying about war. Those ideas seem somehow to be less important because there are greater elements of predictability. Clausewitz dismisses intelligence as having a real value because he says essentially it's based on rumour, it can't be relied upon. We think we're much better at intelligence, that signals intelligence especially, but satellite intelligence gives us much greater precision, which self-evidently it does. And therefore we can see into the enemy and his intentions far better than he deemed to be possible in his own time. I have to say, we still seem to find it pretty difficult. And that's precisely why Clausewitz continues to have relevance for us. Mm. But what we have also learned is that actually technology is not the key determinant in the way in which war is conducted. Of course, it's a crucially important determinant. I'm not being a sort of Luddite gainsayer of the importance of technological, industrial, and of course, information technology change, technological driven change. But what I am saying is that because for Clausewitz's generation, political and social change was so important, that also is how, in many respects, we need to think about war. And for those who went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, dealing with more backward societies, particularly in Afghanistan, than the societies from which they came, that was self-evidently true. Of course, new technologies had applications on the battlefield. But what was also important was understanding Afghan society, Afghan politics, Iraqi society, Iraqi politics, the changes that they were going through and the way in which that affected how they fought. And it brings us right back to Clausewitz.
Yeah. To finish, that's been a wonderful survey, Hugh, of this plainly seminal work. We've had two centuries of it now. You argue that it remains as relevant now as it always has, largely because it ignores the technological aspects of war, which are forever changing, and focuses on those core issues that change much less, which are about human nature, I suppose. Is it a great literary work?
I'm a self-taught German reader. It's Clausewitz. I'm not qualified to judge early 19th century German in terms of its literary quality. There are absolutely moments where the German flows into an English which is direct, precise, to the point, graphic, and which reflects exactly what Clausewitz wrote in German. There are other points where the obstacles between us now, and that includes Germans now, and the German that is written in the early 19th century are quite considerable. I've had German students in my classes, and I've said to them, well, at least you can read it in the original. And they've much preferred to read it in Howard and Bray's translation, because in the end, German is constructed and written differently. I think we would find... it's actually not even comparable with current school pupils engaging with Shakespeare. Mm. I think it's even more difficult than that sometimes for some Germans today. It may be unfair on Clausewitz, but there are moments when for sure it's written in ways that absolutely resonate, and that's for German readers and German speakers as well. And captures something about war which is just magical in the way in which it expresses itself. It's a good question, and one of the things I would dearly love to see done, if we can end with an agenda setting out, is what we still don't have, which we would have for a great work of literature, is what I would see as an annotated text. Mm. I was brought up as a classicist. I read Latin and Greek at school, and was going to went up to Cambridge theoretically to read classics, although I always wanted to read history and ended up doing that. But if you pick up, say, Thucydides in the Greek, you'll have a textual commentary that explores the language as well as the historical context. And we don't have editions of Clausewitz, even in German, that do that. There are moments when he's borrowing phrases from other thinkers. There are moments where he's borrowing ideas from a whole range of disciplines, including engineering and physics and so on, which are not properly attributed. The declaration that you read out, parts of that evoke quite explicitly, in fact, are direct quotations from Guibert, the French soldier philosopher of the 1780s, who anticipated some of the aspects of Napoleonic warfare and wrote equally graphically from time to time. And Clausewitz just lifts that, unattributed. And if you don't know your Guibert, you won't recognise that. But it's not just that. He lifts from the people he abuses, like Jomini and Bulow and many of it. He's not the only one who is confronting the challenge of the Napoleonic Wars and what it means for warfare. And he is part of a wider group, especially in Prussia. He's enormously influenced by a wider group of officers headed by Scharnhorst, who for him was a father figure, the man who'd reformed the Prussian Military Academy and reformed professional military education in Prussia. I would love to see a text, an edition that really, and it has to happen in German first, I think. I don't think you can begin this easily from, there is a new translation in the brewings, but I don't think it will have the time, given the pace at which it's being produced, to go back to this. But I'd love to see an edition that actually told us how this is put together as a work of literature, and then I'd be able to give you a better answer to the question.
Well, there's a project for the future. So thank you, Sir Hugh, for that sparkling survey of Clausewitz's on war. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm always very happy to talk about Clausewitz.
Thank you for listening to EI Talks. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.